Okay. So I have, except they just, you know, they just.
Good morning. Welcome to the Senate Health and Human Services Committee meeting Tuesday, April 12th. We have three bills on the agenda today. And we're going to try to be expeditious in our taking up these bills. And we'll begin with Senate File 103, Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to be here today to talk to you about Senate File 103. This actually is a very simple and straightforward bill, but of course all of you know that the issues involved are not simple and straightforward. I'll first summarize the effect of the bill should it pass and be signed into law. It would be essentially twofold. One is it would discontinue the current policy in Minnesota of using state funds to pay for abortion services in the event that the woman having the abortion is deemed unable to pay for that service herself. So in simple terms, we would discontinue the state funding of abortions here in Minnesota. The second thing it does is to grant original jurisdiction to the Minnesota Supreme Court to hear any challenge, since these are essentially legal issues and not factual issues, and also this has been litigated before in a case that most, if not all of you, are familiar with, Doe versus Gomez. This would be a case that would be amenable to being taken directly to the Supreme Court to deal with the legal issues involved, since the factual issues are really not in dispute and are fairly clear. The issue is if someone is incapable of paying for their own abortion, should the taxpayers pay for it? Now, perhaps as important as what this bill does is what it does not do. It does not in any way challenge the holding or the reasoning in the 1973 U.S. Supreme Court case of Roe versus Wade. And though I do disagree with the rationale and the public policy that has flowed from that, this bill before you does not in any way touch the conclusion or the rationale of that decision and would not in any way alter or change a woman's right to seek abortion services. My position on this, members, Mr. Chairman, is that it is not right for the public, through their taxpayer dollars, to have to fund abortions, which a very large percentage of Minnesotans find to be immoral or an improper way for people to conduct themselves. Now, I suspect some of you may be thinking, well, wait a minute, Senator. We fund many things in this country, and not all of us agree on almost anything. For example, there are people who would not fund the Defense Department at the national level because they are pacifists. There are people who would not fund many other things. But the distinction, Mr. Chairman and members, is that we have a social contract in which we acknowledge that we are going to fund certain public goods that benefit all of us and would not ordinarily be provided in the private sector. And while we all do then contribute to some things that we maybe specifically don't agree with, we do agree that those are things that benefit us all, or at least should benefit us all, i.e. public goods. This is a different situation in that the, quote, benefit, and I use the term very loosely, the financial benefit of funding an abortion flows specifically to an individual. It is not a public good. It does not benefit society at large. Even if you're pro-choice, you have to concede that it does not benefit society at large. It benefits the individual receiving the services, again, using the term, in my view, benefit loosely. So this is different than national defense. It's different than building roads. It's different than financing schools. It's different than other things that we may have disagreements on, but that we all acknowledge we're attempting to do it for the broader good. This is asking taxpayers to pay for a service for a specific person when that individual taxpayer may find that conduct to be morally repugnant, and I don't believe that we should do it. I would point out, Mr. Chairman and members, that a fiscal note was requested and that it was determined that there is no fiscal impact from a Health and Human Services perspective, no negative fiscal impact, no cost, and that any additional costs that may result in the courts would be too small to even calculate, because obviously we'd be dealing with one case in a state that has 5.3 million people roughly, and all kinds of litigation going on. And then, of course, we also minimize the cost to the judiciary by providing for the original jurisdiction so that it should have to be decided by only one court. So in summary, Mr. Chairman and members, I would ask for your support on this bill, and I believe that it is proper for this state, which is out of the mainstream. It goes further than the federal law. The federal law does not allow the public funding of most abortions. We are out on a limb from most states, and I don't believe that we should continue to ask taxpayers to pay for these services. Mr. Chairman, members, that's all I have. I, of course, would be happy to stand for questions, and I'm sure you have a number of folks to testify. I have Jordan Bauer here with me, who is ready to testify at your pleasure.
Thank you, Senator Thompson. And before we take questions, unless there's something in particular members have of the committee, I did want to note for the record we do have a quorum, and perhaps it would be good to hear the testimony. Do you have one testifier in defense of the supporting bill?
Yes.
And Ms. Bauer.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Jordan Marie Bauer, and I am here on behalf of Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life, a grassroots organization of more than 70,000 member families and over 240 chapters across the state of Minnesota. I urge you to pass Senate File 103. Senate File 103 would conform Minnesota's policy on abortion with the federal government by reinstating a ban on most taxpayer-funded abortions. You see, in 1978, Minnesota passed a law that prohibited taxpayer funding of abortions, except in the cases of reported rape, incest, and to save the life of the mother, just like the federal government's Hyde Amendment. However, a lower court ruling in June 1994 struck down that ban, and the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe versus Gomez decision established a right to abortion in the Minnesota Constitution, as Roe versus Wade did on the federal level. However, the Gomez decision went even further by requiring that Minnesota taxpayers be forced to pay for abortions, one of the nation's most extreme policies in regard to abortion. As a result, today nearly 32% of all abortions performed in Minnesota are paid for with taxpayer dollars. This amounts to about $1.6 million per year. From the time of the court decisions until the end of 2009, taxpayers spent over $17.2 million on nearly 55,000 abortions. State tax money in Minnesota is used for a lot of great things. It funds our schools, our parks, our nursing homes. It builds our roads and helps the underprivileged. But in recent years, our taxpayer dollars have also been diverted to the purpose of killing unborn children. So while the vast majority of state money is arguably used to build a better life for Minnesotans, some tax dollars help to end the lives of Minnesotans. A March 2010 poll of Minnesota's 8th Congressional District found that nearly 73% of registered voters oppose using taxpayer dollars to pay for abortions. These results are consistent with other state and national polling data. That means that Minnesota taxpayers, a strong majority who don't want government funds being used for abortion, have essentially helped to end the lives of nearly 55,000 Minnesotans, a number that continues to grow every day. Now is the time for the legislature to represent the will of the people by passing a ban on taxpayer-funded abortions. Some may argue that it is discriminatory to not provide low-income women with a taxpayer-funded abortion. However, federal courts have disagreed with this notion. In fact, for decades, the federal government has forbidden most taxpayer-funded abortions, just as we seek today. This is not an issue of whether abortion should be legal or illegal, as this bill does not seek to outlaw abortion. It does, however, return the issue of whether or not the taxpayers of this state should be forced to fund a practice which the majority of Minnesotans oppose, therefore violating their right of conscience, to the policymakers of this state where the decision is rightly decided. Justice Coyne in the Doe versus Gomez dissent points out, quote, "The majority spurns this court's own advice to the legislature that this important political issue, the funding of abortions, should be decided by the legislature where everyone can have his say," end quote. There are a number of valid points made in the dissent opinion in the Doe versus Gomez case. For example, Justice Coyne, writing for the minority, points out that while the majority in Doe suggests that the right at issue in Gomez is the same as what was addressed in Roe versus Wade, it is not the same right. And quote, that there is a very significant difference between a right to decide to terminate a pregnancy by abortion without fear of criminal complicity and a right to compel the state to pay for the abortion, end quote. Further, as Justice Coyne points out, while Roe v. Wade maintains neutrality on whether abortion is moral or immoral, in the Doe v. Gomez case, quote, the majority promptly abandons all vestiges of neutrality. The majority frankly extols abortion as a positive good and the cure for all the ills from which a pregnant woman could possibly suffer, end quote. We agree with Justice Coyne and believe the state can do better for pregnant women. Rather than just giving them a tax-funded abortion, which the majority of Minnesotans oppose, the state would be better served to provide for them the resources and support that they truly need. A ban on taxpayer funding of abortion is a reasonable measure which should be supported by pro-life and pro-choice advocates alike. And unless we wish to force citizens to fund an act which they do not support and to do it at a rate of more than 10 times every day, we should all be supporting this common sense legislation that protects and respects our fellow Minnesota citizens. I urge you to support Senate File 103 and would be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. Senator Thompson, you have other testifiers?
I have none other scheduled.
I do have a list of three other people who wish to offer testimony. Seeing no questions from the committee, Raleigh Levine. And I also have Charles Samuelson and Jason Adkins. And please state your name for the record. Welcome
yes.
to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and the committee. I'm Reverend T. Michael Rock, pastor at Robbinsdale United Church of Christ and one of the chair people for the Minnesota chapter of the Religious Coalition for Reproductive Choice. It is a gift to be here today, and I'm glad to offer testimony against this legislation.
Mr. Rock, before you proceed, can I ask, are you testifying in place of one of the other people on our list?
I believe I was told my name was not on the list.
Well, I'd like to hear from the people I have on the list first, since we have limited time for the testimony, and I'd like to make sure we offer the people who've agreed to testify.
They just poked me and said, get up there.
Are you testifying in place of someone else?
Am I testifying in place of someone else?
I just have a list. You're not on the list. I want to give people on the list an opportunity.
Unless
they're ceding their place to you, I'm happy to do that, too, but it's up to you.
Raleigh's going to go first.
All right. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I am on the list, and I appreciate your hearing my testimony today. My name is Raleigh Levine. I'm a professor of law at the William Mitchell College of Law. Constitutional law is one of my areas of expertise and interest, and my five-minute statement will focus on why, were Senate File 103 to become law, the Minnesota Supreme Court would very likely hold that it violates the Minnesota Constitution. The Minnesota Supreme Court held in 1995 in Doe v. Gomez that a law just like SF-103 that allowed the use of public funds for childbirth-related medical services but not for abortion-related medical services violates a woman's fundamental right to privacy under the Minnesota Constitution. It has been the law since 1973 and is still the law today that under the federal Constitution, a woman has a fundamental right to obtain an abortion pre-viability. That is, before the fetus is capable of sustained life outside the womb. In Gomez, the Minnesota Supreme Court recognized that women have the same right under the Minnesota Constitution. Even if the United States Supreme Court were someday to overrule its decision that the right to abort previability is a fundamental right, the Minnesota Supreme Court's independent decision about what the Minnesota Constitution protects would not change. The federal Constitution is a floor, not a ceiling. States are free to interpret their constitutions as more protective of civil liberties than is the United States Constitution, and that is precisely what the Minnesota Supreme Court did in Gomez. In holding over just one dissenting vote that funding childbirth-related services and not abortion-related medical services infringes the state constitutional privacy right, the state Supreme Court was well aware that the United States Supreme Court had decided in 1980 in Harris versus McRae that such discriminatory funding decisions do not infringe the federal constitutional privacy right. But as have many other states, the Minnesota Supreme Court rejected that reasoning and explained in careful detail why it had done so. Thus, in Minnesota, the state may make a discriminatory funding decision like the one at issue in Senate File 103 only if it can demonstrate that it has a compelling interest in infringing fundamental privacy rights. It couldn't demonstrate such a compelling interest in Gomez, and it cannot do so now. As the Minnesota Supreme Court held in Gomez, and as the United States Supreme Court decided in Roe versus Wade and reaffirmed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, a state interest in preserving human life and/or in encouraging and supporting childbirth is not compelling unless and until the fetus is actually viable. Moreover, even at the point that the fetus is viable, the state's interest in preserving the potential for life cannot outweigh its interest and the mother's in her life. Senate File 103 bars funding for abortions, even if they are the result of rape or incest, even if they are medically necessary, even if the mother's own life would be put at risk if she continued her pregnancy or gave birth. The bill would thus elevate potential fetal life above its mother's own life. Even were abortion to be viewed as legally equivalent to homicide, the law has always viewed homicide as justifiable when it is in self-defense. A mother need not and should not have to sacrifice her own life for her potential child's. To find that Senate File 103 is constitutional, then, the Minnesota Supreme Court would have to overrule Gomez, a case that has been the law of this land for nearly 20 years. But like other high courts, including the U.S. Supreme Court, our state Supreme Court has said time and again that the principle of adhering to precedent, the principle known as stare decisis, is a critical one to ensure the stability of law that is integral to our democratic society. Thus, the court has reaffirmed repeatedly that it is extremely reluctant to overrule precedent under principles of stare decisis, and that it requires a compelling reason before overruling a prior decision. Disagreement with the reasoning or wisdom of a court's own prior ruling, disagreement of the majority with the decision reached in that decision, does not constitute a compelling reason for overruling a decision. The reasoning of the prior decision must be actually unsound or illogical. Even though the composition of the state Supreme Court has changed since 1995, and even assuming, for the sake of argument, that Gomez is indeed a politically unpopular decision, public disapproval of a decision that was logical and well-reasoned is not and will not be considered a compelling reason by the Minnesota State Supreme Court to overrule it. Thus, I urge you to recognize that SF 103 is unconstitutional under the Minnesota Supreme Court's long-term precedent, and despite the changed composition of the court since 1995, it would be very unlikely to rule differently were the law to come before the court today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I thank you again for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Levine. Before you step away, just one question. You're a constitutional law professor. Where in the Minnesota Constitution is the right to privacy found?
It's contained in Article 1, Sections 2, 7, and 10 of the Minnesota Constitution, pursuant to Doe versus Gomez.
Okay, thank you. Senator Hall.
Mr. Chair and Ms. Levine, just one question. Do you represent the William Mitchell College in
your
opinion?
No, I'm speaking here today on behalf of myself only.
Okay. Thank you.
Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, oftentimes we have had various individuals come in and testify before us that this bill or that bill is unconstitutional. And I again want to remind you that we have a constitutional law professor who has just testified and expressed an opinion. And I can absolutely guarantee you that we could go out and get another constitutional law professor to come in and testify, give a very cogent argument, just the opposite of what you have just heard. And when cases are argued before the Supreme Court, that's exactly what happens. You don't get one side. So I simply want to again remind you that the opinion expressed by this witness is just that, just an opinion, no different than my opinion and no different than your opinion. And our job is to legislate. Our job is not to try and anticipate what the Supreme Court may or may not do. So we legislate, and then if the Supreme Court decides they want to take the case up, they are the ones that will have an opinion that really counts. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Lee. Thank you, Ms. Levine.
Thank you.
Next on my list is Charles Samuelson.
Mr. Chairman, Mr. Samuelson was not able to be here today. My name is Carolyn Jackson, and I'm the lobbying coordinator for the ACLU of Minnesota.
Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you. We are the Minnesota affiliate of the ACLU. We are funded and supported by over 8,500 members in Minnesota. I won't rehash Professor Levine's testimony because my testimony is very similar. I would like to say, Senator Newman, one of the things that we testify to is not only to give an opinion, but to inform the committee in your decision-making process as to what law is out there and what groups are there to look at the law. And in our case, we do oftentimes litigate in the Supreme Court on these decisions, on these laws. One of the things, when the Supreme Court looks at overturning a law, they say, the reasons underlying a particular rule have ceased to exist, or where the rule no longer conforms to the changed condition of society. And Doe v. Gomez was only decided 15 years ago. And so this committee would have to look at, see, what has changed in society over those 15 years. The Minnesota Constitution still contains a right to privacy. The state still funds childbirth services for underprivileged women. And so if you can find that that has changed, then maybe the Supreme Court will overturn its decision. Another finding you might find is that women on public assistance need the government to make medical decisions for them. That would change the terms of Doe v. Gomez. We challenge the proponents of Senate File 103 to produce such evidence, because short of making factual findings on either of these points, the legislature will be asking the Minnesota Supreme Court to make a political decision, not a legal decision, about the state funding of abortion. The Minnesota Supreme Court has held since 1934 that if the question is political rather than legal, the courts will have nothing to do with it in any event. Therefore, because we are unaware of any change in society so material that the Supreme Court must overturn its earlier decision, we ask you to vote no to Senate File 103. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Jackson. Next, I have on my list Jason Adkins.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, members of the committee, good morning. My name is Jason Adkins, and I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Catholic Conference. The Minnesota Catholic Conference is the public policy voice of the Catholic Church in Minnesota, and we are here today to support Senate File 103, a bill to end taxpayer funding of abortion in state-sponsored health programs for people of limited means. The Catholic Church's opposition to abortion and its defense of human life from conception to natural death are well known. All people are created in the image and likeness of God, and their dignity must be respected in life and in law. But the Church's position is not strictly theological. Indeed, on many political and moral issues, the Church voices its concern in the public square in secular language accessible to all, regardless of faith or creed. Abortion is no different. Science and the embryology textbooks are clear that human life begins at the moment of conception. Yet despite this clear evidence, our laws allow women to access abortion at every stage of pregnancy. Most egregiously, the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1995 Doe v. Gomez decision made Minnesota one of the most radically pro-abortion states in the nation. It ruled that the right to privacy guaranteed by the Minnesota Constitution included the right of women to access public funds if they could not afford to terminate their pregnancy. Gomez was a tremendously misguided decision. It has funded over 50,000 abortions in Minnesota since 1995 and has cost taxpayers over $15 million. The defense of Gomez by abortion proponents also undermines the claim that abortion is a personal choice. Gomez coerces the people of Minnesota into paying for what science tells us is the destruction of human life. That is not pro-choice. It is no choice. The legislature should work to have Gomez reversed, and this bill goes a long way toward doing that. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I do have a note from two other people who wish to testify, and I think we can take a couple more minutes of testimony. I have Karen Law.
What's he Good morning. Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. My name is Karen Law, and I'm the Executive Director of Pro-Choice Resources, and I'm here to testify in opposition to Senate File Bill 103. Pro-Choice Resources is a local nonprofit that provides comprehensive sexuality education, financial assistance for abortion care, and after-abortion discussion groups. What seems to be missing from the discourse that's been taking place here in Minnesota are the voices of the women who will be most impacted by the bills that have been recently introduced. Last month at work, I received a call from Susan, who had been recently laid off from work and could no longer afford health insurance. She thought she would be okay until she found work because she was young and healthy. Then she found out she was pregnant. Susan and her husband knew that they needed to focus on the well-being of their 2-year-old daughter and family, and so they made the difficult decision not to continue the pregnancy. During our conversation, I told her she might qualify for Medicaid. Thankfully, Susan ended up qualifying, and she was able to receive the abortion care she sought. Taking away this coverage for women like Susan could force women to seek dangerous alternatives. As we saw in Pennsylvania, lack of funds can force a woman to choose unsafe alternatives, putting her health or her life at risk. We should be focused on making abortion less necessary, not more dangerous and difficult. I know and you know that limiting or restricting Medicaid coverage will not dramatically reduce the number of abortions, but it could harm a woman's health and put her and her family at risk. Sadly, it is apparent to me that this bill would have an unfair impact on women of color, on women who are more likely to be living in poverty, on women who have less access to health care, and on women who are therefore at greater risk of an unintended pregnancy. Even if we disagree about abortion, we should agree that a woman should have access to safe, legal, state-sponsored medical care. Again, let us provide health care coverage for all, not just a chosen few. We must protect a woman's health and safety while preserving the right to personal decision-making. In Minnesota, we have a strong history of supporting a pregnant woman in making personal private decisions, even if those are decisions you might not agree with. The bills introduced are simply an attack on poor women. This is about reproductive justice, and I speak on behalf of the women who have traditionally not had a voice in this forum, and I hope that our state will be wiser than to spend our limited resources to take away a right that has been previously guaranteed under Minnesota law. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Law. Next, Michael Rock. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Mr. Chairperson and the committee. The last will be first, I guess. I appreciate the time, and thank you, Senator Thompson, as well. And respecting Senator Newman's, that your job is to legislate, my job as a preacher is to preach. This is not the place for those kind of sermons in any way, although we sit underneath this eight-pointed star, which all of the theological architecture will tell you represents the new birth in Jesus. 7 days of creation, and the eighth day is a chance for newness in life, and so you sit here and legislate underneath this ancient Christian symbol of this eight-pointed star. And so it's only natural that the job of the religious voice in the public debate has always been to remind folks of the interconnection between society and the individual. That's one of the things that Jesus did all the time in advocating for women and the poor, was to remind folks that there are no personal decisions. They affect all of society. And so when you offer health care to women and their personal choices, it affects the public good. And so there is no divorce between the individual choices and the public good that we are part of. And so that's the role of religious life and all we do. And so, and I'm here today to say that I was taught by my mother, and in honor of Mother's Day coming up, that this idea of honoring women and their choice and their respecting them, and that they can find ways to advocate for themselves and have a decision between themselves and their doctor and their clergy person, if they so choose, what a gift that is to our society at large, to have everyone have that sense of moral agency and right. And that's good for both the public good and for the religious good as well. And so I thank you for your time, and I appreciate the chance to bring the religious life symbolism to life in this hallowed chamber.
Thank you. Mr. Rock, are you testifying in
I'm just saying opposition of this bill.
Opposition bill. Thank you.
We should not restrict funding for people who to make their own choices of their health care.
Is there
the public good?
Thank you. Is there, in your theological perspective, is there room for consideration of the child in the womb?
Absolutely.
But that doesn't rise high enough to be protected by law?
No. In fact, that's been part of the debate all along. That it is a legal right to for the women to make that choice in their body, and it's the choice between the women, a woman and her God, is how this creation thing works. And too often, I think, theologically, men in power have always often tried to control those things that they're not really in control of. And so I've noticed in myself, every time I've let go of control, then I'm allowed to love a little bit more, have compassion a little bit more. And I ask folks all the time in all kinds of settings, both from the pulpit and in this microphone, to lessen our controls so that we can actually live healthy and productive lives.
All right. Thank you. Other questions? Thank you.
Thank you.
Questions from the committee? I did want to, if there are no questions, before we entertain a motion, and if Ms. Levine is still in the room, I did appreciate your reference to the right of privacy, and I am not a constitutional professor. I'm not even a lawyer, so, but Article 1, Section 2 is about rights of and privileges. No member of the state shall be disenfranchised, deprived of any rights or privileges unless by the law of the land or the judgment of his peers. There shall be either slavery or involuntary servitude. I don't see anything about the right of privacy in Section 2. Section 7 is about due process, prosecutions, double jeopardy, self-incrimination, bail, and habeas corpus. And Section 10 is unreasonable searches and seizures prohibited. And I just wanted you to, and I know you're not the court, I'm not asking you to be the court, but you referred to those as the place where the right of privacy is found. And again, I'm not a lawyer, so I just can read the language. I don't see that. Could you maybe just explain where that is?
Mr. Chair, thank you. Yes, the Minnesota Supreme Court has, like the United States Supreme Court, found that the right to privacy is what it calls a penumbral right. It is not specifically enumerated in the Constitution, but it flows from the provisions of the Constitution. All the sections that you reference contain implications of privacy. Our right against unreasonable searches and seizures implies that we have a right of privacy in our bodies, in our homes. Our right to, under the First Amendment, to free association implies that we have a right to meet privately with people, to share our thoughts privately. All of these rights are held to create sort of an umbrella of privacy over our person. And the right to privacy found in the Minnesota Constitution, like the privacy found in the federal Constitution, is a right that is considered to emanate from the enumerated rights. They imply a right of privacy.
Okay. I appreciate your clarification. It's not really an explicit right. It's found in the emanations of penumbras, I believe, is what they
say. Well, emanations and penumbras are the same thing, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Yes.
Other questions? Senator Nino.
Mr. Chair, along that vein, if you use the unreasonable search and seizure, I, for example, if I were arrested and charged with a crime, don't have the right to refuse a DNA sample for DNA matching. That, to me, would seem something that would fall clearly, but yet the argument seems to be that in the realm of abortion, that applies. There seems to be a discrepancy there, some different interpretation. Can you expound on that?
I can, although I do want to say that one of the reasons. So I'm sorry, Mr. Chair.
Ms. Levine.
Senator. I do want to explain that I'm not here to justify what either the federal or the Minnesota Supreme Court has done. My main purpose in coming here was to tell you that I think that given that the Minnesota Supreme Court has said specifically in Doe versus Gomez that a bill just like Senate File 103 is unconstitutional, I simply wanted to bring that to your attention. However, the difference between the kind of search and seizure that you're talking about and the right to privacy has to do with what the state's interest is. I mean, if you have been accused of a crime, the state's interest in finding out whether you have agreed, finding out whether there is physical evidence to support that crime is a compelling one. Moreover, we shed DNA all the time. Even though our bodies are private, certain pieces of ourselves we leave behind every time we touch a table. We leave cells that contain DNA. So the courts have essentially said that's not really within the realm of privacy. Abortion, however, is considered to be a right of bodily integrity. We don't give up that right simply by going out in public. And so the court has treated it as a different kind of privacy, more inviolate.
Thank you, Ms. Levine.
Mr. Chair, this is not the Judiciary Committee. I don't want to get down into that level of discussion, Senator Thompson. If you want to take that up when you're in the Judiciary Committee, feel free. And I think you'll be going there with this bill. But my point is that when we get testimony here in this committee, and to Senator Newman's point about whether something is constitutional or not constitutional, and we get these blanket statements of this bill is unconstitutional, these are very nuanced, complicated discussions with judicial rulings that sometimes seem to be at odds with one another, and we as a legislative body need to legislate what we believe to be good policy and good legislation within a realm of reasonableness. You can cross a line there, but this is a very nuanced issue.
Thank you. I have Senator Benson, and then I'll let Senator Thompson, if you had a final comment, but Senator Benson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Ms. Levine, talked about stare decisis and how, and I'm not a lawyer, so please forgive me if I am incorrect in any of these terms, but how the court is reticent to turn against stare decisis. If that's the case, how does the court correct itself, or what is the mechanism for correcting bad decisions by the court unless it's through a legislative body or reversal of stare decisis, which you said shouldn't happen either legislatively or in the judicial action? And can you give us examples of the court being wrong and how legislatures corrected them?
Ms. Levine.
Mr. Chair. Senator Benson. The stare decisis is a policy. It's not a firm legal mandate. So certainly there are cases in which the court has overruled its precedents, but it depends what we define as bad law. There are decisions that are that we may think are poor legislative decisions, and those are precisely within the realm of the legislature. There are other decisions in which the court has said what the Constitution means, and that is firmly in the realm of the court. It is only the court that can decide what the Constitution means, and it is only the court that can correct itself if it has gotten that wrong. There have been times when the court has decided that it's gotten it wrong. Bowers versus Hardwick, Lawrence versus Texas, involving privacy rights as well, and whether those encompassed consensual gay sex is an area in which the United States Supreme Court decided that it had gotten wrong its interpretation of the Constitution. But that's not something that the legislature can dictate to the courts. Just as there's a separation of powers that apply to both branches, and just as the court cannot dictate to the legislature what should be legislative decisions if they don't violate the Constitution, the legislature can't dictate to the court what it thinks is the correct interpretation of the Constitution.
Senator Thompson, you have any concluding remarks to make?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I would like to address just a couple of issues. First off, this issue of the privacy right. It is correctly stated by the professor that there is no stated right of privacy in either the Minnesota Constitution or the United States Constitution, and many of us believe that that was an ill-advised decision that originated with, I believe it was the Griswold against Connecticut case back well before Roe versus Wade. I'd also like to address this issue of precedent and our duty to legislate consistent with the Constitution. We all took an oath to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and I believe that every member here takes that very seriously. However, I believe we all have the ability to make judgments on our own, and there are times that precedent gets overturned. And even though the Doe versus Gomez case is only roughly 15 years old, a lot has changed on the front of what we know about the development of the fetus, abortion, and the like. There are lots of good reasons to believe that the Minnesota Supreme Court might take a different look at this case. Let me speak for just a moment as a licensed attorney, which I am here in the state. In fact, our rules allow, as the professor would know, for making arguments specifically against court precedent. I, as an attorney, can be sanctioned if I bring a frivolous claim. But a claim is deemed not frivolous if there is a good faith argument under existing law or a good faith argument to overturn existing law. And I believe in this instance we have a very good faith argument to overturn the existing law. We have expanded our privacy right, which, as Senator Han, the chairman, correctly points out, doesn't exist in the Constitution except through inference. And we have very much a good faith argument for that. And finally, Mr. Chairman and members, the important point to keep in mind is we are not in any way altering a woman's right to have an abortion with this legislation. We are simply asking the taxpayers who may find this procedure to be morally repugnant should not be asked to pay for it. With that, I would respectfully ask your support, and thank you for your time, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Marty.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, just question of your intent under this. The current MA statute allows state funding, the one that was thrown out by the Supreme Court, allows funding for medical necessity, such as saving the life of the mother. Your bill doesn't have any such thing like that. In other words, do you think that even if it is the life of the mother at stake, we should not be using state funds? Is that the intent? I'm just asking.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, actually, if you look specifically at subdivision 1, we specifically allow for, I'll read it, funding for state-sponsored health programs shall not be used for funding of abortions except to the extent necessary for continued participation in a federal program. So we have drafted the legislation in such a way to make sure that we don't violate the United States Constitution or put us out of conformity with any applicable federal legislation. And so the way we're dealing with that is we're applying the federal standard here in Minnesota.
Sir Marty.
So, Mr. Chairman, Senator Thompson, you would not be challenging, you're intending this to challenge beyond that issue, not that issue. In other words, you would not be intending this to go to court to try and say we shouldn't have to do that to still get the federal funds.
Senator Thompson.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Marty, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking if I am attempting to try to create a standard in Minnesota that would be even below the quote-unquote protections that the federal standards have, and that is not what we're attempting to do by this legislation. We are attempting to remain in compliance with the federal requirements.
Senator Fischbach, did you have a motion?
I'll make a motion.
Unless somebody else.
Move the bill, where
please,
does it go?
Please, Senator Fischbach.
Where does the bill go? I'll make the motion.
I think we need to move this to judiciary. So Senator Fischbach moves that Senate File 103 be recommended pass and referred to the Judiciary Committee. And Senator Bergman.
Mr. Chairman, there are some of us on this committee who don't agree with this bill and don't agree with Senator Thompson. There are some of us who believe that protecting a poor woman's right to privacy is a public good worth defending. And there are some of us who believe that poor women who cannot make their own choice about their health care oftentimes end up relying on public assistance in many other ways. Ways that this very own committee we're sitting on today has decided we can't afford. We have not funded subsidized adoption. We have not funded the counties adequately to help poor women who are trying to get off of public assistance by seeking employment. We have not funded other health care for children who are born into poor families on this committee. And so at this time, to have a bill come before us that will cause a lawsuit, cause the expenditure of state funds to defend the Constitution, some of us believe is ill-advised at this time, and so some of us will be voting against this bill.
Thank you. On Senator Fischbach's motion, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
The motion is passed and the file is referred. Thank you, Senator Thompson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for your attention.
Next, members, we have Senate File 649, Senator Hoffman. Senator Hoffman, whenever you are ready, you may proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Senate File 649 is a bill that prohibits abortions at or after 20 weeks post-conception age unless certain exemptions apply. It also provides civil and criminal penalties. And so I'm just going to review the bill here quickly, and then we can go to questions or whatever the chair wishes. Or testimony. Section 2 of the bill sets up a special revenue fund for the purpose of providing funds to pay for any costs and expenses incurred by the State Attorney General defending the act. This section also outlines how the fund will be maintained and how it will be funded. Section 3 includes new language that will be added to the current reporting form that is required to be filled out by the physician or the facilities performing abortions, and that form will be turned into the Commissioner of Health. Section 4 gives the definitions of the pertinent terms used in the bill. Section 5 outlines the legislative findings based on the documentation. Members should have that in their packets. Section 6 directs physicians to determine the post-fertilization age of the unborn child and outlines the failure to do so as unprofessional conduct already contained in statute. Section 7, the language in this section is contained that prohibits abortions on unborn children whose gestational age has been determined to be 20 weeks or greater. It gives exceptions to this prohibition in Subdivision 2. Section 8 is the enforcement clause of the bill and outlines the criminal penalties to any person who violates Sections 145.4141 to 145.4148. and provide civil remedies to the woman upon whom the abortion has been performed or the father of the unborn child. Section 9 provides for protection of privacy in court proceedings of the woman upon whom an abortion has been performed. And Section 10 is the severability clause of the bill. So with that review of the bill, I would like to ask the chairman if I can allow Ms. Rao from MCCL to...
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hoffman. And Ms. Rao, please introduce yourself and bring the microphone close.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Andrea Rao, and I represent Minnesota Citizens Concerned for Life. MCCL is a grassroots organization consisting of more than 240 chapters and more than 70,000 donor families throughout the state of Minnesota committed to the single issue of life itself. It is my privilege to share this new legislation, the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act, with the committee. This legislation would prohibit abortions on unborn children at the point that the unborn child feels pain, specifically at 20 weeks after conception. At 20 weeks after conception, which is most often referred to as 22 weeks into a standard 40-week pregnancy, a woman is 2 weeks past the halfway point in pregnancy. Even though viability is about 1 week after this point, some babies have been born at this stage of development, and even earlier, and have led a healthy life. An unborn child at this stage has hair, working vocal cords, sucks her thumb, grasps with her hands, kicks her little legs, and measures 12 inches long. But most importantly, for the sake of this legislation, there is consensus that the unborn child at 20 weeks after conception can feel pain. I would like to take a minute to draw your attention to the findings section of the bill. The findings outline a number of key facts related to the ability of the unborn child to feel pain. And these findings have been backed up with abundant written documentation that you should have in your folders. It looks like this. To summarize the information, there are a number of facts that are not disputed in the medical community. First, Pain receptors are present throughout the unborn child's entire body by no later than 16 weeks after conception, and nerves link these receptors to the brain's thalamus and subcortical plate by no later than 20 weeks. Second, by 8 weeks after conception, the unborn child reacts to touch. By 20 weeks after conception, the unborn child reacts to stimuli that would be recognized as painful if applied to an adult human, for example, by recoiling. Third, application of such painful stimuli is associated with significant increases in stress hormones known as the stress response. Fourth, subjection to such painful stimuli is associated with long-term harmful neurodevelopmental effects, including altered pain sensitivity and possible emotional, behavioral, and learning disabilities later in life. And fifth, for purposes of fetal surgery, fetal anesthesia is routinely administered and is associated with a decrease in these stress hormones. The subduing or elimination of this stress response is crucial due to its impact on the unborn child's survival rates and long-term effects on development. There have been a small handful of medical literature reviews that indicate that the unborn child may not be capable of feeling pain until somewhat later in the pregnancy, but these appear to contain biases. Most with expertise in the area of fetal pain, including the fetal surgeons who do these surgeries, agree with the consensus that the unborn child is capable of feeling pain at least by 20 weeks post-conception. Pain and the empathy that we all feel toward those experiencing pain is an innately human experience. Every parent whose child is hurt and every child whose parent is suffering pain due to illness or disease strives to ease that pain. We have many laws, customs, and traditions that seek to protect others from pain. Should we not extend this to the most vulnerable child, the unborn child? The loss of a loved one, especially a child, is always tragic, and I have great sympathy for any family that suffers such a devastating loss. Years ago, when prenatal screening was much less sophisticated and more children were born with disabilities and anomalies incompatible with life, it was not uncommon for these newborns to be untreated and left to die. That became illegal in Minnesota decades ago, as the citizens of our state decided that those children were deserving of the respect and dignity that we offer to other struggling members of our human family. Similarly, this legislation is not about whether or not women have a right to abortion, even in relation to adverse diagnoses of their unborn children. In fact, nearly all of the abortions in Minnesota that are done because of a fetal anomaly are done earlier in pregnancy. Rather, this legislation is about whether or not an unborn child who is developed to the point that he or she is capable of feeling pain is deserving of the respect and dignity that we offer to other members of our human family. Consider that nationwide, the most common abortion procedure at this stage of development is a D&E, or in layman's terms, a dismemberment abortion. That means that the doctor reaches in with the forceps, grabs a limb, and pulls until it rips off. He removes it, then goes back for the next one until he has removed every piece. If the unborn child feels pain, as experts believe, imagine what that child must endure. Today, fetal surgery is a growing medical specialty, as conditions like spina bifida can sometimes be treated before a child is even born. Prior to these surgeries, unborn children are now routinely provided pain medication. While most children at 20 weeks after conception are not able to survive on their own, viability is generally only about 1 week away. And according to the Minnesota Department of Health's annual report, we are performing abortions on viable babies here in Minnesota. I would like you to take a look at this diaper here in my hand. It's a size 1. I'll admit there's a one size smaller than this called newborn, but when I had my 3 kids, they all had to go straight to the size 1. The newborn diapers were a little too small for them. This diaper is for preemies. This diaper is for those babies that are just barely viable. I think it's amazing that we have children that are born that are this small. These are the babies that we are trying to protect through this legislation. Babies that are capable of feeling pain. Babies that are deserving of the respect and dignity that we give to other members of our human family. A pain-capable unborn child, viable or not, is a member of our human family, and we believe is sufficiently developed to be recognized as such and protected by law. We believe that the state has a compelling interest in protecting the life of an unborn child capable of feeling pain, and I urge each of you to support the Pain-Capable Unborn Child Protection Act. Thank you very much, and be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Rao. Senator Hoffman, we've got a couple of amendments here. Are these things that you wanted to offer as author's amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have the A1 amendment. And just for the record, my summary did summarize the A1.
Okay. Senator Hoffman moves the A1 amendment. Are there questions? Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, I just wondered on line 1.12 of the amendment, there's a reference to an appropriation made by the legislature. I just wondered if we have an idea of what that appropriation, how much that would be.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berglund, not at this time. That will be dependent on cases that come before the Attorney General.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman and Senator Hoffman, I would like to suggest that we don't appropriate money after the fact. So if there's going to be an appropriation made, it would have to be made either by this committee or by the Finance Committee. And I have said before, I believe that our work is to tell the Finance Committee what we believe we need to be spending. So, again, I would ask you if you have an idea of what appropriation would need to be made.
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, the purpose of that clause in the bill is not to appropriate money from the state government, but it's to set up a fund so that if people want to donate to defend this bill, that they have the ability to do so. So that it's not so much to take taxpayer dollars, it's so that people from the community that believe in this bill could donate to help defend it.
Well, then,
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, then I would suggest that perhaps that should be made clearer in the language because it would appear that the appropriation would be made by the legislature out of a state government fund. I also would just then ask if it would be your intention, if there are no contributions made, that then the defense of this legislation would come out of the Attorney General's budget that would be provided by the legislature this session.
Senator Hoffman, did you have I guess the question I have, maybe counsel can offer some advice. Does the provision for an appropriation to this type of account require that an appropriation be made, or is it more in the event that such a appropriate? I mean, I'm just questioning the mechanics of.
Mr. Chair, I think this language is that if an appropriation would be made by the legislature, that it would then be put into this account. There's still a question of whether the legislature will actually appropriate money.
Right. Okay. So maybe, Senator Berglund, to your point, if this is viewed as a provision in the event an appropriation is made, right, that we could decide not to make an appropriation at this point. Although we could decide, I suppose, if we wish to as well, but I'm not sure that I don't see any provision in the bill for an appropriation. Is that correct?
Okay.
think that's correct, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berglund.
Well, Mr. Chairman, that was my point. If we're making an appropriation, I think the people on the committee deserve to know how much we think it would be.
Sorry.
If we're only allowing an appropriation to be made from donations and gifts, you still do need to put authorizing appropriation language in the bill. We've had other bills that are intended to be funded through grants or other private funds, and just collecting the money doesn't automatically mean it gets appropriated. So I'm just pointing out, I think this these lines 1 and 2 need a little bit more work on them.
Okay. All right.
Second language that would approach could fix this very easily.
And Senator Berglund, and I, and maybe why don't we act on this amendment? I think there's a second amendment that may address that issue. So Senator Hoffman moves the adoption of the A1 amendment as an author's amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? The motion is adopted. And Senator Hoffman, did you also want to adopt the A2 amendment?
Yes, I'd like to move the A2 amendment. And basically this amendment is bringing the language of the bill into conformity with our current how things are set up in Minnesota.
Members and Senator Berglund, I think the language in 1.11 and 1.2 are designed to account for any funds that would be received. Is that the intent of the of that amendment?
Spend those.
And council is saying that they were given permission to expend those monies by this amendment as well. Are there other questions on the A2 amendment? Senator Hoffman renews her motion on the A2 amendment. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Amendment is adopted. Are there other questions right now? We do have a couple of other testifiers on the list and someone who's also sent me a note they'd like to testify. Senator Higgins.
Mr. Chair, Senator Hoffman, you just made a statement saying that you were putting this language into how we do things in Minnesota. Has this bill come to you through an organization that's nationwide? Something that's kind of a generic bill that you're required to, or you're forced now into making it a Minnesota bill?
Senator Hoffman.
Mr. Chair, Senator Higgins, the bill itself is based off of Nebraska law, and we were just bringing the terminology into conformance with Minnesota terminology.
Thank you.
If there's no other questions, I'd like to invite Father Andrew Cousins to come to the table. Thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please introduce yourself. Bring the microphone close so we catch your remarks on tape. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Father Andrew Cousins. I'm here on behalf of the Minnesota Catholic Conference, representing the Archbishop of St. Paul, Minneapolis, and the more than 1 million Catholics who live in the state of Minnesota. And I want to speak on their behalf to encourage the senators to pass this bill. Of course, science has come a long way since abortion became the law of the land in the United States some 38 years ago. We now, as has been mentioned, have the ability to do intrauterine surgery on children as young as 20 weeks, and we know that these children are rapidly approaching the stage of viability outside the womb. I myself baptized a baby at 21 weeks, born just a few hundred yards from here in United Hospital, the youngest baby to survive out of that hospital when I was the associate pastor at the cathedral. That baby is still living and active today. In fact, there's no difference in a certain way between that 21-year-old weak baby in the womb and the 21-year-old weak baby that I baptized, and both of them ought to be given the same legal protection. Of course, thankfully here in Minnesota, we have lots of help for these women who can bring their children to full term. We know, and we in the Catholic Church stand ready to offer many services to them to help them to do that. Finally, the bill is important to me on a personal level, and this is why Archbishop Neinstedt asked me to testify today. When my own mother was 20 weeks pregnant with me, her water broke, signaling trouble in the pregnancy, and she went to the doctor. who, after running some tests, told my mother that the child in her womb was a freak and that she should have an abortion. Now, although my older sister always agreed that in a certain way that doctor was right, thankfully, my mother chose differently and reverenced the life in her womb. She asked for a second opinion, and that doctor helped her to carry that baby to full term. And I was born a month early, but otherwise quite healthy. It's living proof that, in fact, the diagnosis of doctors is not always accurate at this early stage in development. And many children who are given a diagnosis of not to be able to survive outside the womb, in fact, do survive outside the womb. And even if those children have handicaps, we never consider a painful death the answer to handicaps for a child already born. And so we ought not consider that the answer to a child who's capable of feeling pain before birth. So I'm happy to be here today to raise my voice on behalf of these vulnerable children and hope that, in fact, in Minnesota, we will treat abortion like it should be treated, which is, it's a very serious issue that not be an easy answer. Rather, it's a permanent solution to problems that otherwise can be solved other ways. So I encourage you to vote yes in favor of this today, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Father Cousins. Are there questions for the witness? Thank you. I have also Raleigh Levine. Welcome back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, again, thank you for agreeing to hear my testimony on Senate File 649 in addition to Senate File 103. I again plan to keep my comments to 5 minutes, and I would ask that you please incorporate my previous comments relating to Senate File 103 into my testimony on Senate File 649. Like Senate File 103, and for many of the same reasons, Senate File 649 violates the Minnesota Constitution's privacy right as interpreted by the Minnesota Supreme Court. It also violates the federal Constitution's privacy right as interpreted by the U.S. Supreme Court. The Minnesota Supreme Court held in Doe versus Gomez that under the Minnesota Constitution, the state's interest in preserving fetal life is not compelling enough to justify a ban on abortion unless and until the fetus is actually viable, capable of sustained life outside the womb. That's true even if exceptions are made for abortions that are medically necessary to preserve the mother's life or health. In Roe versus Wade and again in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, the U.S. Supreme Court held exactly the same thing under the federal Constitution. A state interest in preserving fetal life is not compelling unless and until the fetus is viable. As Casey put it, and this is a quote, regardless of whether exceptions are made for particular circumstances, such as when an abortion is medically necessary, a state may not prohibit any woman from making the ultimate decision to terminate her pregnancy before viability. I am not a medical expert, but my understanding is that the overwhelming majority of fetuses are not viable at 20 weeks. And my understanding from the bill is that there is no finding that the legislature differs. Senate File 649, nonetheless, bars non-medically necessary abortions starting at 20 weeks, at a point when fetuses, the vast majority, are not viable. Thus, Senate File 649 violates both the Minnesota and the federal Constitution. The state has asserted a compelling interest in preventing fetal pain based on findings that are admittedly contested. Section 5G of the findings, line 5.7 through 5.10, acknowledge that the findings on fetal pain being experienced at the age of 20 weeks post-fertilization is contested. But a state interest in preventing fetal death, according to the Minnesota and U.S. Supreme Courts, is not sufficiently compelling to justify a ban on pre-viability non-medically necessary abortions under either the state or federal constitution. Even assuming that fetuses do feel pain at 20 weeks, the state's interest in preventing fetal death is obviously weightier than the state interest in preventing fetal pain. Thus, the state's lesser interest in avoiding fetal pain cannot possibly be sufficiently compelling to justify a ban on pre-viability abortions, even non-medically necessary abortions. The 2007 U.S. Supreme Court case, Gonzalez versus Carhart, again reaffirmed Casey and Roe. While Gonzalez decided that a ban on one abortion procedure, the so-called partial birth abortion, did not violate a woman's federal constitutional right to privacy, the court was careful to stress that the reason that such a ban was constitutional was that an alternative abortion procedure remained available. Thus, Gonzalez affirmed a ban on one non-medically necessary pre-viability abortion procedure because there was an alternative procedure available. Thus, no decision from either the state or the federal high court would support a decision that the state's asserted interest in preventing fetal pain could justify a ban on all non-medically necessary pre-viability abortion procedures if a state interest in preventing fetal death could not do so. But even if both courts, and it would take both courts, were to reverse their precedents and somehow determine that an interest in preventing fetal pain is compelling, more compelling than an interest in preventing fetal death, the state would have to overcome another enormous obstacle. It would have to establish that the state must bar virtually all pre-viability abortions to avoid fetal pain. And that's a hurdle no state could clear. Fetal anesthesia would be equally effective and far less draconian a means of avoiding such pain. To find that Senate File 649 is constitutional, then, both the Minnesota Supreme Court and the United States Supreme Court would have to overrule decades of their own prior decisional law. As I explained in my testimony on Senate File 103, both courts firmly and consistently applied the doctrine of stare decisis and would be extremely reluctant to overrule their precedents. Thus, I urge you to recognize that Senate File 649 is unconstitutional under both the Minnesota and the federal constitutions as interpreted by the ultimate arbiters of those constitutional provisions, the Minnesota and the federal Supreme Courts, and to recognize that despite the changed composition of both the state and the federal Supreme Courts since the seminal cases of Roe and Gomez, both courts would very likely strike it down were it to come before them today. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, I thank you for allowing me to testify today.
Thank you, Ms. Levine. In your testimony, are you saying that you would support a bill that would require fetal anesthesia to be applied before an abortion? Is that your testimony?
No, Mr. Chair, I'm suggesting that were the state to recognize a compelling interest in preventing fetal pain at the age of 20 weeks, which is, again, a contested finding that fetuses do feel pain at that stage, if that were a compelling interest, then a way to serve it without intruding on the right to privacy would be to provide fetal anesthesia as opposed to outlawing all abortions.
All right. Other questions? I do have two other people who have indicated they'd like to testify. Linnea House. The committee, please state your name for the record.
Thank you. My name is Linnea House, and I'm the executive director at NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. To begin, before I do my testimony, I would like to submit for the committee some findings that we have that go to Section 5 about the legislative findings on fetal pain. I have information here from the University of California, San Francisco, the Bixby Center on Global Reproductive Health. I'll just read the first sentence so that you know what's in here, and then I'll submit this to you. They're sending information to us about the findings on fetal health, and they're saying that these findings are inconsistent with published science and thus should not be used to inform potential policy change. So I'll submit this here. And again, my name is Linnea House, and I'm the executive director of NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota. Thank you. My organization represents over 60,000 Minnesotans throughout our state, and my mission and our mission is to guarantee every woman the right to make personal decisions regarding the full range of reproductive choices, including legal abortion, preventing unintended pregnancies, and bearing healthy children. NARAL Pro-Choice Minnesota supports the legal framework of Roe v. Wade, but and does not oppose restrictions on post-viability abortion as long as they contain adequate exceptions to protect the woman's health and her life. However, we do oppose Senate File 649 because the health exception in this bill is dangerously narrow. This bill lacks an exception to protect a woman's health against grave risks posed by potentially reversible medical conditions and goes even further to explicitly disqualify even the most serious of mental health conditions from being permitted exceptions to this ban. This bill also lacks an exception to fetal anomalies. It is for these women that I come before you today to share their voices and to share their stories. It is inexcusable that women facing difficult and sometimes life-threatening health problems in pregnancy get lost in this debate. I'm here to make sure that that does not happen today. Some women need later abortion care. The reality is that while most women welcome pregnancy and can look forward to a safe childbirth, for some, pregnancy can be dangerous, and abortion restrictions that do not have adequate health exceptions endanger these women. Women facing the most dire of circumstances are among those who receive the 1.5% of all abortions that occur after 20 weeks. For example, I'm going to share some women's stories for you. When Dawn Mosier was 4 months pregnant, she and her husband Timothy learned that the fetus she was carrying had the most severe form of spina bifida, which had forced the brain to develop at the base of the cranium. Timothy testified in opposition to the Nebraska law. All treatable options became no options at all. The damage was beyond repair. After much consideration and prayer, Timothy and Dawn decided that they did not want a life of suffering for their child and chose to terminate the pregnancy. Another story is when Tiffany Campbell was 19 weeks pregnant, she learned that her pregnancy was afflicted with a severe case of twin-to-twin transfusion syndrome, a condition where the two fetuses unequally share blood circulation. The diagnosis was that one of these fetuses had a strained heart, an acute risk of heart failure, while the other had a blood supply that was insufficient to sustain normal development. The Campbells were told that without a selective termination, they risked the loss of both. At 22 weeks, in consultation with her doctors, they made the difficult decision to abort one fetus in order to save the other. Today, under the Nebraska law, the life-saving procedure that they underwent is illegal. And finally, Vicki Stella, a diabetic, discovered months into her pregnancy that the fetus she was carrying suffered from severe major anomalies and had no chance of survival. Because of Vicki's diabetes, her doctor determined that induced labor and cesarean section were both riskier procedures for Vicki than an abortion. The procedure not only protected Vicki from immediate medical risks, but also ensured that she would be able to have future children. These are just a few examples of women in Minnesota who face pregnancy complications and have to make the tough decision on what to do. At least they got to make a decision based on their health, their pregnancy situation, and the medical advice of doctors. If Senate File 649 were to pass, women like these would no longer be able to make the decision that is best for them because the Minnesota legislature would have already made the decision for them. This law also lacks necessary exemptions. This abortion law bans abortion care after 20 weeks with only a narrow exception for the life of the woman and no exception to protect the woman's mental health or for cases of rape or incest. A law such as this, without appropriate exceptions, could threaten a woman's health or her ability to have children in the future. As I just mentioned, this ban lacks an exception for instances where the pregnancy is the result of rape or incest, even when the women are survivors of sexual violence are young girls. Under Senate File 649, abortion after the point of viability is permitted only if the doctor determines that she has a condition which so complicates her medical condition as to necessitate the abortion of her pregnancy to avert her death. Or to avert serious risk of substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function, not including psychological or emotional conditions. No such condition shall be deemed to exist if it is based on a claim or a diagnosis that the woman will engage in conduct which would result in her death or in substantial and irreversible physical impairment of a major bodily function. That's Section 7. Such care is also explicitly prohibited even if the woman's mental health is so jeopardized that the woman faces the threat of death or harm through her own actions. That could result in mentally ill women being forced to discontinue medication essential to their mental stability and to be hospitalized and even perhaps physically restrained to prevent injury to herself or to others until the baby is born. Does the state of Minnesota really want to force some women to be nothing more than incubators? Finally, the 20-week law is unconstitutional. The root of our opposition to Senate File 649 is our firmly held position that women and their doctors should make health care decisions, not state legislators. Circumstances surrounding pregnancy can be complex, and it is impossible for restrictive legislation like Senate File 649 to account for every situation. Every pregnancy is different, every fetus is different, and medical science does not make presumptions, even rebuttal ones, just because the law does. There should be no presumption of fetal pain in law when medical science does not even have one. I urge you to vote no on this legislation. Women facing difficult and sometimes tragic complications in their pregnancies need to be able to make the best decision for them based on their medical condition, the recommendation of their doctor, and the beliefs of their family. I trust women to make these decisions, and you should too. These difficult decisions must not be legislated by the Minnesota legislature. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Ms. House. I do have one other testifier. Just one question before you leave, Ms. House.
Yes.
Is the child in the womb or the fetus, is that a human being before it's born?
I think that science has not made that conclusion of when life begins. I think it depends on your faith, on your medical background.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you. I have also Teresa Collette, who would wish to testify. Welcome to the committee.
Good morning, Chairman Hahn, other senators, distinguished guests. My name is Teresa Collette. I'm a law professor at the University of St. Thomas, where I teach constitutional law and bioethics, as well as property law and other courses. But in addition to being an academic lawyer, I'm also a practicing lawyer. I'm currently the Special Attorney General for the state of Oklahoma, defending their abortion law related to ultrasound. I have experience defending laws in court as Special Attorney General, not only for the state of Oklahoma, but for the state of Kansas, and assisted Attorney General Ayotte, now Senator Ayotte, from the state of New Hampshire and the United States Supreme Court, defending that state's law related to parental involvement in a minor's decision to have an abortion. The testimony I'm about to give does not represent the views of the state of Oklahoma, New Hampshire, or Kansas, nor does it represent the University of St. Thomas. It is my personal view, but it is a result of my professional experience both as an academic and as a practicing lawyer who specializes in this area. I felt it important that I testify today in light of testimony that's been offered to this committee that this bill is clearly unconstitutional. I disagree with that opinion and, in fact, believe that while it is an open question, there is a substantial chance that the United States Supreme Court would sustain this law. In the prior testimony from another lawyer, what you heard was that abortion law is static, that once the Supreme Court has made a decision, that decision is written stone, and that the legislative acts in support or contrary to that have no impact. And yet, the simple fact is that Roe versus Wade was substantially modified by the United States Supreme Court in Planned Parenthood versus Casey. In that particular case, the Supreme Court rejected what it called the rigid trimester system that denied the state's interest in fetal life from the moment of conception forward. Justice Kennedy, in the Webster opinion, clearly recognized that fetal pain is a significant state interest, and even Justice Stevens, a strong proponent of what he characterizes as abortion rights, recognized that fetal pain was an important consideration that state legislators could take into account. This bill does not, in fact, affect the rule that the court has adopted saying that states can prohibit, with appropriate exceptions for the life of the mother and the health of the mother, all abortions post-viability. What it does is it proposes that the state's interest in preventing fetal pain at the 20th week post-fertilization, which is 22 weeks post-gestational weeks, is a sufficient interest that the state can ban abortions with appropriate exceptions for health and life of the mother. This is not an exceptional position for the state to take, particularly in light of the Supreme Court's opinion in Carhart versus Gonzalez. Your Honors, in that particular case, in that particular case, the United States Supreme Court held by a majority opinion
that the federal government could ban the procedure of partial birth abortion, even though it had no health exception and indeed impacted mid-trimester abortions. This law simply expands the protection of the state on a new public interest, as well as one additional week. The 20-week rule that others have referred to is usually gestational age. We are talking about extending protection for one additional week, but more importantly, we are talking about the state of Minnesota recognizing what one of the judges in the partial birth abortion cases recognized was excruciating pain. The fact is that this is constitutionally relevant. The most important fact, though, for this committee to know is that notwithstanding that the Nebraska law has been in effect for 18 months, notwithstanding that it had one of the most notorious third trimester abortionists in the country practicing at the time the law was passed, not a single constitutional challenge has been brought to the Nebraska law. In fact, Dr. Carhart of the Carhart versus Stenberg and Carhart versus Gonzalez opinion cases decided to close up shop rather than challenge the Nebraska law. I doubt there's much better evidence that, in fact, it is constitutional. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you. Senator Newman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members, thank you, Ms. Collette, for appearing before us. Members, what you have just experienced is exactly what I was talking about in the previous bill. And what you have just heard is an equally cogent argument on the other side of the issue and why the court system and the judges always refrain from making any kind of pronouncements as to whether a proposed law or a bill is unconstitutional before they have actually heard the case. And so it's a very good reminder to us, again, that our job is to legislate, not to try and guess what the court is going to do in any given case.
Thank you. Other questions for the witness? Seeing no other questions, Senator Hoffman, did you wish to make a motion?
Yes, I'd like to move the bill and recommend that it pass to judiciary.
Okay, as amended.
As amended. Thank you.
So Senator Hoffman moves that Senate File 649 be passed and referred to the judiciary, passed as amendment, referred to the Judiciary Committee. Senator Berglund.
Mr. Chairman, there will be some of us on this committee that will be voting against this bill today. We believe that the science that we have available to us on this subject does not support this legislation, and that this is not a good time to ask the Attorney General without resources available from the state to take on this magnitude of a case. So some of us will be voting no today.
Thank you. Any other comments from members? On Senator Hoffman's motion, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed?
No.
No.
The motion is passed and the bill is referred to judiciary. Thank you. Members, we are going to recess here till 5 p.m. to room 123. We have one other bill that we would like to hear today, and so I hope that is not too great an inconvenience to members, but until 5 p.m. we will recess.